You're listening to part two of There's No Scoreboard in the Office, Inside the Athlete's Journey, a two-part podcast series from producer Karen Given exploring the athlete experience as they move on from their playing careers and the challenges they face along the way. If you haven't listened to part one, you can find the episode by searching Global Sport Matters Podcast wherever you listen. And now, on to the show.
Hi, this is Ken Shropshire. Welcome to part two of Inside the Athlete's Journey. Karen Given did a great job of kind of giving us insight into what athletes think, the positioning they take, the steps that they take as they head through this amazing journey that most of us don't have to endure. Today's podcast will focus on the post-sport journey as well. And it's a roundtable. The discussion will feature the Global Sport Institute's own Scott Brooks, Dr. Scott Brooks, the director of research, and Shannon McHugh, who's a co-founder of the Post Game Players Lounge. Karen, tell me what you guys are talking about.
Yeah, so it's...
Don't spoil it.
Well, it's an interesting conversation about the physical and mental health challenges of the post-sport journey. Dr. Shannon McHugh and her colleagues have recently launched this program called the Post Game Players Lounge, which is a place where athletes get together and talk about all the challenges that they face. There's a lot of mental health training, more than counseling, right? Like coaching on how to handle the many mental health challenges of the post-sport journey. But they also end up talking a lot about the physical health challenges and how to navigate the healthcare system, which is something that I didn't realize athletes have never had to do before.
No. I look back on my sordid sports career, and especially the post part, the idea that it's not there anymore. And you really did a great job in the first feature going through that. Yeah, I was talking with a players union representative last week, and one of the things we were talking about was how different it is depending on how you left the sport. If it was injury, yeah. If it was you're no good anymore, whatever it might be that could be different. If somehow a talent evaluator just decided you weren't that good anymore, and you get the second chance with another team. So all that just goes in so closely with the mental elements, which are just now being appreciated.
I mean, it has been a very interesting couple of years. I remember it wasn't that long ago where athletes just didn't talk about mental health at all unless it was related to performance. Like you could have a performance coach, right? You could have someone who helped you swing the bat better. But other than that, they didn't even talk about the issue. And it's been really interesting to watch as athletes and the rest of us open up about something that we all experience.
I've said mental health in sports is like water used to be. Coaches would say, don't drink water during practice. It makes you weak.
Right.
Craziest thing. But, now we know you need to be hydrated and otherwise. And in the same way that, what's wrong with you? Get that out of your head. When in fact, you should address what's in your head. And we're just coming to that now, which I think is 30 years too late for me, but I think it's great.
Cool. Should we get to the conversation?
Let's get to the conversation.
As Ken mentioned, I'm joined by Dr. Scott Brooks, Director of Research for the Global Sport Institute. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Good, thank you. And Dr. Shannon McHugh, psychologist and co-founder of the Post Game Players Lounge. Hi, Shannon.
Hello. Excited to be here.
Shannon, let's start by talking about the Post Game Players Lounge. Tell me about how this got started, because it's relatively new.
Yeah, it's our COVID baby, I always say. So long story short, Dr. Jesse and I were child psychologists, and we were noticing that while we could have one kid in our office for like 45 minutes and try to help them, they're not super motivated to do these things, right? Because they're little kids and they don't have, it's not directly going to affect them to actually make major changes in their life. So what we had decided to do is Jesse and I kind of had this long dream of being able to incorporate physical health activities into teaching kids about mental health so that they didn't have to get to my office. And so we developed this program and we were getting it into school districts, and then COVID happened. So we had the wonderful opportunity to be connected with somebody who had a lot of referrals for retired NFL players who were dealing with mental health issues. And so both Jesse and I started working with them individually. And as we were working with them, basically the one thing that we saw in common with all of our clients, every single one of them, we've seen about 60 or 70 retired NFL players at this point, is all of them were missing that team sports environment. And we kept saying, God, if we could just get these guys in the room together, like they would see so much more progress. Because the one thing I love about athletes, especially elite athletes and retired athletes, is that they are really dedicated. They're not like our kid clients who will go home and not do anything. They come with notebooks and they go, okay, this is the playbook to life. And we're going to like sit down and take this seriously. And so I love that. And so we channeled that into, let's just run a group and see what happens. And so we got a group of about 10 to 12 guys that were all retired NFL players. And it just turned into the most amazing thing. They were so empathetic with each other, so understanding. And these guys were motivated to show up to a meeting that they didn't have to go to. So it was like we were seeing way more than just them kind of having fun and being able to laugh for an hour and learn something for an hour. We were also seeing dedication, showing up to things when they when they're experiencing anhedonia, which is like lack of interest and motivation. We were seeing them isolate from all sorts of people. And we had guys that would show up, and it was all Zoom based. It's still Zoom based, but we had people from all over the country. And there were guys that were nervous to talk to other people and would have their camera off and not talk and use the chat sometimes. But now, a year and a half later, these guys are introducing new guys to the group with their camera on, and they're talking. And so we're seeing all of these amazing things that we would have never been able to see in an individual perspective. And we're seeing growth with these guys in a way that we never really expected. And so it's just something that's been so rich for our lives that we've kind of, now we have this like blend of the stuff that we do where we work with kids and we use a fitness kind of component to help them understand it. So we always kind of have that athlete perspective, but we have this amazing passion for this group of people because the NFLPA, for example, does a lot of things to help support them moving on to something else and doing all these things. And they talk about the need for mental health services and refer them to mental health professionals. But nobody is doing the pre-work, which is preparing these guys beforehand, which is part of what we want to do, is the education piece beforehand. But it's also about actually having groups that are specifically about how are you transitioning. That's just not, we look everywhere and we're like, somebody must be doing this somewhere, right? And nobody is. And so what we've decided is that we're going to do that, and we're going to be the people who can hopefully access the guys who really need that transition support.
Scott, I want to bring in the physical health aspect to this. As Ken mentioned, I recently spoke with Russell Hinder, who played in the NBL. That's the Pro Basketball League in Australia. And he told me that when he retired, he gained a bunch of weight and he was already dealing with bad knees, bad ankles, bad hips. He even showed me his pinky finger that was bent completely the wrong way.
I'm going to show you my pinky finger right now.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
That's not right. That's not right.
That's about the average reaction. Oh my God, that's not right. Yes.
So with all of the health issues plaguing former athletes, why did you decide to focus on sleep apnea?
Wow. Well, I think it was really fortuitous. So we started thinking about sport in the body. And in doing so, we came across Robert Turner. So Dr. Turner and I, Dr. Turner is a medical sociologist at George Washington University. Let me get that right. And he and I go way back. We actually met early 2000s, a sociologist studying sport. And he had a new book that had come out, NFL Means Not For Long. And in it, he was talking about concussions, but he started with youth football. And so Dr. Turner played college football, played a little bit in the NFL, and then played more in the Canadian Football League. And what he said was, you know, Scott, this concussion thing is interesting, particularly when you're looking at Black males. Brain injuries can come from trauma and from stress. So he was saying with a lot of football players coming from low income, single parent households, there's stressors and things like that. We know in terms of cardiovascular, there's higher rates of asthma, right? Some of these other breathing illnesses and lungs and heart. And so he said, you know, these are things that people aren't really looking at. And with our overall focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion, and looking at race it became a natural fit for us. And it's really something that we think we can make a difference in, right? So injury, what are you going to tell people? Hey, you don't want to hurt your ankle, so don't compete. That's really not going to do anything. But if we're talking about sleep apnea, there are things that we can do to improve sleep. There are broader issues when we're looking at communities of color around health literacy. So this gets us an avenue in to talk about health literacy and other issues plaguing Black communities. So that's really how we got into it.
And it's really interesting because I've always thought of sleep apnea as one of those things that we think of, oh, lots of people have that. It's fine. But there's really a lot at stake if this isn't diagnosed and isn't treated, right?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, again, while there are a lot of people who may have it, when you have other pre-existing conditions or when based upon, you know, race and the stressors that come with race based on class, these things get exacerbated. And that really becomes it. Blacks have higher rates of hypertension. Of course, hypertension, more stressed you are, the more you may have disrupted sleep. It just may not be good, clean sleep. And so those are the kinds of things that you add to it. Rates of hypertension, more rates of sudden death, right? Of just stroke or those kinds of things. That's the reason why it's really important that we talk about sleep apnea as a way of improving health. So not just we worry about sleep apnea, but of course, the greater amounts of sleep you get, the healthier you can be. So, you know, sleep really is one of these things that it's like when they tell you drink more water. Well, of course, we always heard you should sleep more.
Now, for retired athletes, is there also an element of weight here? Because so many retired athletes then have trouble regulating, like they're used to eating all of these calories and suddenly they're not working out 6-7 hours a day anymore.
That's right. And I, you know, jokingly, I would tell you that's a good excuse for me, right? Like I'd love to be able to blame it all on that. But yes, there's definitely correlations to weight gain. Again, sleep is important in weight gain. And again, all of these are things that just compound, right? They add, they're on top of each other. And they get you into less healthy lifestyles. They will impact your sleep. They'll impact just your well-being, right? And not feeling good. And I know that's where we can easily bridge into mental health, right? That there's that aspect.
Absolutely. That's where I was going to go next, because all of these physical things definitely affect your mental health. And then there's the mental health of just no longer being able to do this thing you've done your whole life. So, Shannon, what do you see former athletes struggling with in terms of their mental health?
I think it's so interesting. As I was listening to you, Scott, the whole time I was thinking, of course, like these are the things that I talk a lot to the guys that are in our groups and in my individual work with retired athletes about, is the fact that there are going to be so many identity shifts when you go from, I am an elite athlete. Actually, in our group just before this, we were talking about this, is that the identity piece is probably the most important thing and the biggest thing that guys struggle with, or athletes in general. I work with a lot of NFL players, so they're mostly men. The identity piece, right? And a large part of weight and body image and all of that stuff is so interconnected. I just read this study talking about the main factor that contributes to whether somebody feels good about their body post-sport is whether or not they still believe that they have an athlete mentality. They are an athlete still, instead of like a retired athlete or someone else, you know? And so what they're finding is if your body sticks with the same kind of societal standard and doesn't change all that much, you probably have body acceptance. But the two things together that cause the big problem are the identity piece. If you can still consider yourself an elite athlete and your body shifts from what that societal norm is, that's when body acceptance goes down. That's when depression increases. That's when all these things happen, right? So overall, I would say the main struggle that most of the athletes that are retiring that are struggling with the transition seem to experience is the being able to add retired to the beginning of their identity as an athlete.
This whole thing can get really dark. I want to go back to another thing that Russell Hinder said last week. And he was talking about the feelings that can come up when you can't do this thing that you love anymore.
When you retire, or when you get cut, or when you don't make a team, that frustration, that anger, that rage. And I've had that. Believe me, I've had that. And it's taken a while to to sort of find comfort and find peace. And some guys will never find that and don't find that and drink themselves into a stew and drug themselves into. And it's hard.
Russ paints a pretty dark picture. Is this the kind of thing that you're hearing?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I think most of the people who wind up seeing me to some degree are stuck in that state of really feeling like their identity in general, but their feelings about their themselves as a person is now gone based on the fact that a lot of reasons become physical. So the physical representations of these injuries and those kinds of things make them no longer able to do this thing that their mind really believes is the only thing that they're good at. And so I've definitely had, we've had guys in our groups that have said how in order to get out of the situation in which his family was in, it was either you become a singer or you become a football player. That's a really big struggle to then become a football player and have all of this amazing idea that you're going to get your family out of poverty and you're going to be able to really be this amazing elite person who gets all of this attention and also feels really good about themselves, and then getting an injury that makes them no longer capable of doing that. It's not everyone, right? Because you see all of these people that do the transition pretty well, but those people generally, at least this is my hypothesis from the difference between the people who see me and people who are transitioning pretty well and don't need it, is either that they left on their own terms and that there wasn't something that was like really devastating to them that was out of their control, or they had other pieces of their identity that they're clinging on to now that are helping them to still feel like they have a purpose or worth.
When I think about this, some of the challenges, and one of my best friends, he passed away, but he was someone I coached with. He was in his late 70s and he still considered himself a basketball player. That was his identity. He would introduce himself as a basketball player. When we talked, he would talk about our guys, and they were basketball guys. When he would attend funerals, it was all the guys showed up and it was a community, right? So part of what Shannon is speaking of in this is you're dealing with individual stuff and you're dealing with larger kind of how others see you. And there is this kind of praise that you're used to getting. And so for people who are able to stay in a community, but if not, and you manage it on your own and you're feeling all of these things that, you know, and it's at such a young age for retirement, that's generally we're thinking AARP, right? So we're thinking, all of that's coming. You're going to get the magazines and you'll get discounts. And so at 26, you've got to already be retired. I mean, how do you deal with that? What do you do with the rest of your life? They get thrust into it, most of them, not on their own terms. And how does anyone deal with that well?
Yeah, yeah. I want to bring us back around to the idea of finding a community, because Shannon, that's a lot of what you do at the Postgame Players Lounge. So explain how your program works and how it creates this sense of community.
Yeah. And again, as you were talking, Scott, I was like, oh my gosh, that's why we're doing what we're doing, right? Is there's this huge piece of, and what we say all the time is that for people who were in a team-like environment with a sport, which is most people who are doing athletics to some degree, they have always thrived and succeeded with other people around them that had the same mentality and they were focused on the same goal, right? So these people get through a very intense amount of elite performance that nobody ever really accomplishes, like very, very rare. 1% of people in the world accomplish these goals. They all do it together and they have this team and they have people telling them what to do and they have all of this stuff going on and just people that are there with them going through it. And then all of a sudden they get that retired at the front of their name and it's all gone. And yeah, they have friends and family and all of that stuff, but it's not an everyday in the locker room kind of situation. And so then they start to feel isolated. And so what we do at the Postgame Players Lounge is we recreate the team environment focused on, instead of performance and getting out there on the field or the court or whatever, we focus on them talking about mental health, what's going on in their houses, what's going on with their transition, in a way where BJ Williams, who is, we call him our chief facilitator, but he's a former player who kind of asked all the right questions and kind of facilitates our groups. He talks about it as, locker room talk with mental health professionals. And literally, it's mostly self-guided. So the guys come in, and what we have started doing is presenting like a little nugget of mental health information, just because what we're finding with a lot of these athletes is, yeah, they have tons of information about how their body works and how calories work and how intake works and out and output and all of those things. And they have to some degree some mental training in how to perform on the field. But very rarely do they even understand the general concepts of your thoughts affect how you feel and your feelings affect your actions, right? And so what we do is me and Jesse, who are the resident psychologists, present a mental health nugget of information, and then we allow it to open up to the group and they process kind of how they're experiencing it, or it might not even be related to that at all. We talk about pedicures, we talk about all sorts of things, and it's all kind of related to helping them have a place that feels really supportive to them to be able to just kind of go, oh, I'm going through these things and it doesn't feel like I'm by myself because I have my team again.
Scott, I've seen you nod your head quite a few times while Shannon is talking. What do you feel as you hear all of this?
Well, in many ways, I feel like Shannon's the answer to prayer. Like, we're trying to figure this out. We want to help out as many athletes as possible. And I think it's an amazing thing that you were able to discover this during the pandemic. And so I applaud you, and I'm excited to hear more and figure out how we might work on this together. You know, one of the things that stands out for me in this, and it is about how do you keep them going and really thinking of the social, psychological factors that come with being a part of a team. So very much what Shannon is highlighting, right? So the routines, having someone that is able to give you directions, having all the support folks. There's also the aspect of improvement, right? So they're very much about accountability. The other piece for me is that games do something special. So a question I would have for you, Shannon, is have you thought about, you know, I know that they're competitive and sometimes that's what you'll see come out, right? Guys want to get there early. They want to express how they've got the most notes or they've done more, right? There's that natural competition. I have found that the game thing is a thing that when I hear of groups, organizations, or people doing this, that often gets left out. They'll say competition, but when you hear athletes talk about missing the crowd, that's about games and their mm-hmm. status that's conferred. That's the validation that the work you've put in matters. It's actually worked. It's not just in practice. So that would be one other little wrinkle that I still haven't figured out exactly how to do throughout some of my programs, but I think it would kind of kick it up a notch and even get them even more excited.
I love that, because we've been having these conversations about like, what does it look like? How can we use this in a way that's really helpful for everybody? And a major thing we were talking about is emulating the different parts of sport that are the most important. So having bye weeks or preseason, postseason kind of like thought process to our groups, because we are really trying to emulate the team and sport-like environment in our programs. And it's funny because we talk about that all the time, but we have never really talked about the game. And I love the idea of trying to figure out what those things can be, because I do think that's a big issue. And you talked a couple of minutes ago, Scott, about the amount of praise that they got during their sport. And we talk about that all the time, is there's internal motivation and external motivation, and the internal praise is not something that these guys have ever really needed because they got so much external praise. And so it is about, there's a grief process of being able to grieve a little bit of the fact that it's never going to be that intense again. But it's also about channeling, like once you accept, acceptance is a big part of our program, right? Once you accept the retirement at the beginning of your athlete name, where can you get praise in a way? Where can you get that external validation where you can start to make those connections? Like a guy that I work with is doing frisbee golf now, and like that's something that he's really into. But again, the physical limitations of a lot of the people that we work with makes it really hard, right? It's not like they can just go into another competitive sport. So it might need to be something else, but you've got my wheels running about like, how can we have game time things? Because I do think that that's missing in a lot of programs, and now I want to figure it out.
That's so interesting. I mean, over the years, I've interviewed so many athletes who have had that sort of post-athlete career where you're just like, why did you choose this? You know, like an athlete who decided he wanted to be an actor and did a Broadway show. And I was like, what does that have to do with anything you've done before? But it is that external praise piece, right? It is that being in the spotlight and being adored for something.
You know, it's also, you know, in someone who studies youth sports, I tell people the one thing in basic parks and rec sports that never, even if it's rained out or whatever, they always have a makeup day for is picture day. You can lose all the games, right? It could snow out, this and that. There will always be a picture day and always be a second picture day. There's something about the pomp and circumstance, right? There's at the youth level, it's just parents being able to buy blankets. I mean, you can buy anything now. It's blankets, cups, mugs, fake trading cards, all these things to show that your baby girl or boy is fantastic at something, even if it's all pretend, right? I've had parents who I'm coaching, you know, they're 5, 6-year-olds, and they say, you may not be good, but you're going to look good, right? The kid had a fresh haircut every weekend. And, you know, this is the kid who was done after warmups. I mean, it was hilarious. Warmups are done. And they're like, "Ooh, coach, I'm tired. I'm going to go sit down." And I'm like, we haven't even started the game yet. But it doesn't matter. They look good. They felt good. So I would tell you, you know, everything from, you know, we're going to wear these shirts or we've got shirts, right? All that kind of things that brings people together. It says I'm a part of something. There is something to that identity, that praise, and communities of color where they know that they're a part of a group, the extrinsic motivation. And this is where sports psych, I think, sometimes gets it wrong, because the motto is it's about your intrinsic motivation, not when you come from communities that are communal. And then this is where you are playing for other people. And we know that that's a higher motivation. What athletes can find is by giving back. And that would be the other thing, right? So the athletes who are giving peer advice, peer mentoring, those are also some of the critical things when we're looking at pro-sport journey and in mental health. We know it feels better to go out and serve, right? It feels better to do those things. You'll forget about some of the things that you're feeling. It'll just distract you for a little bit.
Yeah. Shannon, you mentioned BJ Williams, who is one of the co-founders of your program, and he's done a whole lot of work specifically in communities of color, trying to reduce the stigma of dealing with mental health. How much of an impediment is that in your work?
So it's interesting because I feel like every time Scott's talking, I'm like, oh my gosh, I forgot to mention another piece. Yeah. Like a large portion of the reason why we started the program that we did with the kids in general and teaching them about emotional and mental health was in order to target the populations of Black and Brown kids who are not getting education about that at all, who also don't have the resources to actually go seek a therapist a lot of times, or the stigma of the idea of mental health in those communities, which is all very, very true and a major barrier to a lot of the support that we're trying to provide. And so BJ is a long-term friend of mine who it was interesting because I was watching his work and I kept saying, we're going to collaborate at some point. We're going to collaborate at some point. BJ is doing amazing work at reducing the stigma, which is a large part of what we talk about in our groups, which made him a really easy blend in all of this stuff, because he currently not only does these things with professional athletes where he does documentary style interviews where he talks to people about mental health, and most of them are Black men, to reduce that stigma and also just to get people talking about vulnerable stuff. But he also has started a program based on those documentary series in schools where he goes into a school that he actually is an educator at, and he runs a curriculum for high school students and has some of these athletes come in and tell their story, allowing them, first of all, the opportunity for mentorship and those kinds of things, which they could never have gotten, you know, without this connection, but also to hear other Black men and women who are athletes and like the strongest of the strong talk about mental health stuff. And so, yes, to answer your question in this long-winded way that I'm answering it, it is a big barrier that I think is our major thing that we're trying to combat, especially because a majority of the people that we end up working with are Black men in particular. And this population of people have this idea that they are the strongest of the strong physically. And so they, I think that there's a jumping to conclusions that their mental health should be as strong. And I do think what Scott was saying about how he thinks sports psych gets it wrong, I also feel that way a lot of the time as somebody who's in the psych world who is not a sports psychologist. Sports psychologists are amazing at doing what they do, which is getting people on the field and performing at peak performance, right? And there's tons of ways that sports psychologists do that and are able to manage the mental health of a team to get them to the successes that they get to. The difference is, from a developmental psychologist perspective versus a sports psychologist perspective, they're trying to get people to perform. What I'm trying to get them to do is cope. You know, I think a lot of these guys have been introduced to mental health services in a way that it was very potentially like traumatizing, where it was like, oh, if you don't get it together, you're going to go have to see the shrink before we let you back on the field. Or, oh, go talk to that person before you come back because it looks like you're having a problem kicking the ball and we need you to be able to kick the ball, right? And so, like, all of that to say that in combination with the fact that these sports organizations are a business and a lot of this is about getting guys back on the field, particularly the more famous and likable ones, right? And so the idea, there are a lot of times, I don't think that this is with every sports psychologist, but I do think that there are a lot of times that they have encountered someone who kind of facilitated that stigma. Somebody was not really there for them. They were there for the win of the team. They were there for the owner of the team. They weren't really there to see if they were actually okay. And then what does that do other than further this stigma that society is already giving that you can't be a Black man and struggle with mental health?
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I could talk about the mental health angle of this all day, but I want to bring it back to the physical because I think there's a connection here. And it's something I didn't realize until I was doing some research for this conversation, but I understand intellectually that athletes, elite athletes, haven't had a lot of access to the developmental side of mental health, right? Certainly the performance side, but not so much in that sort of just being a well-rounded human who can get through this world and everything it throws at you. But what I realized recently is that pro athletes often don't understand the physical healthcare system either, right? That's also all been provided by the team. They've never had to make an appointment to see their doctor. They've never had to sit in a waiting room for hours past their appointment time. What effect does that have on retired athletes?
I would say the first bit is just general kind of functioning as an adult, right? So as an adult, yeah. Do you know how to take care of yourself? Do you know what to do when this happens or that happens? When it's been done for you, you don't really have the skill set, right? And so you go from being totally dependent, but not thinking of it as dependency, right? You're the prize commodity, right? So you kind of are entitled to this. This is what comes with it. And you may come not to trust it. So you speak with doctors and they say you're okay to get back on the field, but you know and feel you're not. Now what happens? And let's say you get re-injured. Now you're going, no, I don't trust these doctors, right? And why should I trust these doctors? That becomes part of the problem because we've interviewed some athletes through our sleep apnea focus groups, and they talked about doctors' health versus real health. And they'll say things like, doctors will always find something wrong. And their thoughts are, but I've been fine, right? They've learned to cope physically. Like when it comes to physical stuff, there is a coping. It doesn't make it any healthier than the way they're coping mentally, but there is a coping. I would argue it's probably the same stuff, right? So just as Shannon alluded to, you know, they're being told, set that stuff aside and focus, not deal with it. And it's the same thing when it comes to physical stuff. Are you injured or are you hurt? Can you go on? It just doesn't feel good. Or do you need to step out because this is harmful and you won't? We've been praising playing through pain, right? I wrote an article about this playing through pain and particularly looking at youth who get scouted and are called soft. So they have to disprove that they're soft by going harder and being more physical, which puts their body in more harm. And then if it doesn't work out, it's the kid just didn't cut it. Like maybe they weren't tough enough mentally. Their body couldn't handle it. Nobody is saying, well, what did we do to make them think they needed to do more? So, you know, the physical thing is a big thing, and it very much mirrors physical health and mental health. We need to talk about them in the same light. We need to pay the same amount of attention to this. And we just don't. We're taught to shove that stuff away and just stay at this job.
Yeah, I mean, I keep trying to make distinctions between the mental health aspect and the physical health aspect. But the more we talk, the more I realize we're really talking about two parts of the same thing. They're super connected.
Which is interesting because in the last couple of weeks, a lot of our guys have been sharing about how much they distrust mental health and physical health providers. And Dr. Madison Harris is an occupational therapist who is a part of our team, who specializes in helping with the more functional side, physical wise, but also just like financially and all those things. And she's a wonderful asset because she like specializes in helping people try to figure out how to have a structure in their day and how to do all these things that are very difficult. But she was running a group a couple of weeks ago where they were talking about the fact that they like cannot trust providers anymore because of the experiences that they had on the field. I've heard multiple stories about guys who have gone in, gotten a medical check, been told that they were fine or whatever, and like, you know, had a serious concussion and really felt dizzy, and they were put back on the field and then got really injured, like you were saying. And it's just the distrust in the system based on the business part of sports is a really big problem because, you know, it really does create a different stigma. And the physical aspects of the rest of their life, especially if they were in a really hard sport like football, like they're always going to be involved in some kind of interactions with a physical health medical doctor. Like it's just, you know, for a lot of these guys, like they've got replacing knees and doing this and doing that. And they're 26 years old and they're looking and they're saying, like, I have guys that say it's like crazy. They look around and it's like, I feel 65. Like, I feel like I should be retiring. It is so interconnected. Like, and that's why I say, like, our post-game players lounge ends up being a group where people are talking about their physical health almost as much, if not more, than their mental health. And it always comes back to the mental health part of it, of they can't make decisions about their care because they were not provided with the support that they needed during that time to actually make those decisions themselves. And so they really do feel like novices in the world, that they're having to relearn everything.
We're going to have to wrap up soon, so I'm going to ask you both the same question. If you could change one thing about how we support the health of former athletes, what would you do?
What I would say, the immediate thought that came to my mind was education and prevention, right? And I think so. Being able to, and it's more than just saying, hey, by the way, your career is going to end, you need to have a different identity, right? Like it has to be the way that we're talking about sports in general, changing the conversation from the Simone Biles of the world who doesn't feel like she can get on a beam and do something really dangerous when her head is not connected to her body. Is there a way to like talk about that differently than somebody who goes, oh, I'm too scared, I want to give up? Because I think that those things are totally different. And so my immediate thought is like education about the symptoms that could come, and then having a support system after that to transition appropriately.
So you're talking about letting athletes know what might happen to them after they walk away from the game?
Totally. And not just saying like, oh, this could happen, but also saying like having them complete a course where they have to actually sit down and write down information of like, if I get an injury, you know, these are the plans of what I would like to do instead, or this is how I would ideally want to transition, so that they have the information of not just, oh, it's not going to happen to me, because I think that's what happens to 90% of these players is like, yeah, that guy broke his ankle and now can't play anymore, but it's not me. Right. And it's like, more than likely it is going to be you if you really look at the statistics. And so it's important to be able to say like, no, you actually have to have a contingency plan. A lot of businesses, you don't need that if you have a degree or if you have this or that. But when you're in a physical business, you have to have a contingency plan because you're not, because NFL, right? Not for long. Like, it's just not for long. And you have to be able to prepare for that if you want to go into this professionally.
All right, Scott, what would you change if you could?
So I'm going to go with the Miss Universe, or to not have that kind of gendered, I'll say Mr. Universe answer. And that is not world peace, but I would tell you education in general. Part of what we know is that youth who feel like this is their only way out, right? It stems from not having other options. It stems from them coming often from places where not only is it that there aren't role models, but even if they had an idea, they don't have access to the resources. So my dream has been, you know, I did my dissertation and a lot of research in Philadelphia in an amazing summer league. Every men's NBA player of the last 20, 30 years went through our summer league, including Kobe Bryant and Rasheed Wallace, Kyle Lowry, who's in the league now. And I was amazed because in our literature on urban sociology, Black men are not supposedly around working with young Black men, right? They're absent. That's what policy around welfare and everything tells us. But I was in a league where there were men all the time. There are men in playgrounds, working with these kids very informally, AAU coaches and the like. And I said, well, what if there were leagues that were engineering leagues, right? What if there were leagues that were, you know, lawyer leagues? What if we had this kind of league structure around these other kinds of potential occupations? Because that's how our kids in inner city Philadelphia are thinking about it. So I'd want us to open up others. And with the baby boomers, we have a lot of people who have retired and are coming from occupations where we could go and invest and show kids other alternatives. Doesn't have to supersede or mean we no longer have kids excited about sport. I just want them to have other opportunities. To Shannon's point, you can't just tell them, go find something new. It's too late at that point, right? They feel behind. People don't always understand how deep it is to feel behind. That's a part of what happens to those who get that retired, right? So I was ahead of everybody. I'm an elite. And then now the next day, I don't know anything. I don't know how to call a doctor. And they feel so behind. And that leads to such great depression. But if we have them on a track where they're exposed to a lot of different ideas and they can feel success, and that's what I think we need. We need education that exposes kids to many other things that they can dream about, aspire towards. And if they're amazing athletes, they can stop one day and be right on track, as some of ours have. But that's my kind of Mr. Universe, pie in the sky. This is what I dream we could create.
I love it. I love it. Dr. Scott Brooks is the Director of Research for the Global Sport Institute. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
And Dr. Shannon McHugh is the co-founder of the Post Game Players Lounge. Thanks, Shannon.
Of course.
This episode was produced by Karen Given. Be sure to subscribe to the Global Sport Matters podcast wherever you listen to get notified of new episodes out each week. This two-part special from Karen Given is part of our September digital issue, The Athlete's Journey, exploring everything from the lived experiences of athletes throughout their sporting careers from around the globe to challenging systems of abuse in gymnastics. You can find the issue out now at globalsportmatters.com. Global Sport Matters podcast is a production of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Our manager of marketing and communications is Crisol Valencia. Our digital communications specialist is Brendan Clean. Our events and programs manager is me, Kendall Jones. And our marketing and event assistants are Natalie Skegan, Kate Nelson, and Aiden Corrales. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at Global Sport MTRS.